This morning I want to preach a sermon on what makes for a great church. We here at East Shore are kicking off what ought to be an upbeat, vigorous period with multiple opportunities to become a healthier, stronger community, to refine some of our systems, our organizational structures, and eventually, several years down the line, of course, call a settled ministry. So things are clearly in transition. Consequently, today is a good time, a propitious moment to ask, well, what indeed are we doing here? Let me take this sermon to tell you what I think you're doing here, or we are doing here, or at least trying to do. To nurture and keep alive a thriving, creative, truly liberal Unitarian Universalist congregation here in Bellevue and environs. Well, what are the keys to such a community? What will enable our efforts to flourish, to bear good fruit? I think there are four ingredients, four dimensions. Now, when I started thinking about this years ago, the image that initially came to mind was that of a four-cylinder internal combustion engine, an engine in which, when it's functioning smoothly, all four pistons are moving smoothly and in sync. And in those years, I had a funky 1965 Volvo four-cylinder with CV carburetors that I was constantly trying to keep going. You could, in those years, work on your own car. It was a lot simpler. A few years later, by now the early 90s, I came across the image on the cover of today's bulletin, discovered in a book by the Reverend Richard S. Gilbert, Minister Emeritus of Rochester, New York's first Unitarian Church. I'll employ the mechanical four-cylinder engine metaphor some, but mostly Reverend Gilbert's wheel image throughout my remarks this morning. The four-cylinder engine model makes sense in that automobiles have many parts and many subsystems that all need to be in proper tune for the engine to run smoothly. From time to time, one subsystem, the electrical system, something about the timing or what have you, gets out of whack. So the mechanic, the minister, tinkers with things until she or he gets it all running smoothly again, at which time some other part probably could use her or his attention. When everything is working perfectly, even if only for a short time, the congregation can really thrive. It can really hum. People are joining, programs expanding, and the coffers are full. A good minister keeps at it without too much anxiety, believing that her or his hard work will eventually bear fruit. But like the good mechanic, one has to keep paying attention by checking in, listening, and keeping everything well oiled. Now let us consider Dick Gilbert's wheel. At the center, worship and the celebration of life. Now, worship is one of those words that some Unitarian Universalists struggle with. But the etymology of the word, as I understand it, is worth-ship, the act of making worthy or remaking worthy. Making ourselves more worthy, making our efforts and our aspirations worthy by centering them again, grounding them in the tradition, in what we hold most dear. Archaeologists and anthropologists describe the content of ancient worship as ritual and as dance. This is where religion probably began, celebrating shared joy around a campfire with song and music. The single most frequently mentioned aspect in common among growing churches is that they are festive. They celebrate coming-of-age ceremonies, honoring elders, anniversaries of important congregational milestones. What are we celebrating when we do that? Ultimately, we're celebrating our connectedness to one another. The great fin de siècle, or turn of the century, end of the century, 1880s, 1890s, Oxford classicist Jane Ellen Harrison used to quote Aeschylus in claiming that ritual was one of humanity's three great inventions: fire, or the domestication of fire, habitations, and ritual, worship. A people's educational and cultural values are passed on in worship by way of ritual. So the traditions, here's, you know, the mythology is acted out, and the important milestones and important customs and protocols and taboos are all delineated, all dancing, as it were, around that campfire. Ritual then celebrates our connectedness to each other, to the culture at large, and also our connectedness to something deeper. Something deeper. Now, there's an ancient myth that gives us a clue to the deeper connections that rituals can and sometimes do get us in touch with: the Egyptian myth of the mad king. The story goes like this. Once upon a time, a great sovereign sends his child on an important secret mission. The youth is to go to Egypt, blend in, mingle with the people, and await further instruction. And so the young person obeys, journeying abroad to that ancient land, finding a place to live and a trade, and settling down. To become fully engaged and integrated into the life there, the child learns the language, makes friends, finds a spouse, and starts a family. Moreover, life is good. In time, our hero all but forgets about the mission. Indeed, were it not for occasional dreams and vague memories, she would have forgotten altogether. It goes on like this for a long time, until one evening on her way home, a man in uniform introduces himself as an emissary from her father, the king. "It is now time to return home," he explains. "Follow me." Confused by the abruptness and unexpectedness of the encounter, she dismisses the man. Moments later, though, retracing her steps in search of him, he is vanished. Except for, is it his business card lying there on the pavement? A note on the back of which reads, "Your heart knows the way. Follow it home." Now, the ancient world organized social life to ensure that we all got word from our homeland and started back to regain our rightful throne. The process was called, and still is, initiation. Initiation into our deeper mind, our collective unconscious, or, to use the Unitarian Ralph Waldo Emerson's term, into our true, capital S, self. Some years ago, while serving a church in suburban Pittsburgh, I led an adult religious education program, the Canticle of the Cosmos, in which we watched and discussed a 12-part video series narrated by the mathematical cosmologist Brian Swim. In it, Swim describes the human condition in the language of cosmology, quantum physics, biological science, and traditional wisdom. The Earth, as he describes it, is an intelligent, self-regulating planet, and we, human beings, are products of the Earth. That we come out of the Earth. We are fruits, as it were, of the Earth. So let us for a moment contrast the two images here of humanity. The biblical image most of us grew up with, and a model fashioned in accordance with the understandings of Brian Swim and other scientists, some of them quite open to the mystical ideas that also informed the transcendentalists like Emerson, Thoreau, Whitman, and Margaret Fuller. The old image of human beings as heaven-sent strangers on earth who, after suffering nobly through this mortal coil, are released, if you've been good, to return to your rightful home in heaven. That's the old image. But this image is hopelessly out of date, for the truth is that we do not come into this world at all. We come out of it. The new image of humanity is as a natural product of the earth, for indeed, our earth is peopling. Just as the apple tree apples and the vine grapes, our earth is peopling. If we are intelligent beings, then we must be the products of an intelligent earth, symptomatic of an intelligent energy system. For you can't gather figs from thistles or grapes from thorns. Some people, I suppose, never come to this insight. Others do, but uncertain and unsupported in its meaning, dismiss it. Nevertheless, it can be nurtured. And that's what worship is all about, nurturing our connections, including the deep internal connection to the creative heart of life, to the self, the still small inner voice, the heart of hearts, the Atman, the still point at the seat of the soul. Say something spiritual. I am forever being petitioned. Something intellectually stimulating, something that's hopeful, that's emotionally honest, and also, oh yes, up to date. All this I try to do. All ministers try to do this. But whatever we say, it also has to touch the wellsprings, or folks will eventually find something else to do with their Sunday mornings. So, worship and celebration are at the center, at the very heart of what we do, the taproot. The outer circle, however, is just as important. Note that in this image of a healthy church, all four components of a healthy congregation touch the other three. In other words, all these aspects of congregational life link together with one another, influence one another, and connect with the other three. What does this mean? Consider the second element of a healthy church is that it's a caring community. Members support one another, take care of one another in crisis, and behave like, often as, a group of loving friends. Here at ESUC, we have an excellent lay pastoral ministry team. Indeed, you've done a very good job organizing yourselves to look after one another, make regular calls on shut-ins, and fill in the gap between a Get Well Soon card and a visit from the minister at the hospital. Being a truly caring community also means being non-judgmental and understanding of another's views, ideas, and, within reason, lifestyle. Healthy congregations are communities where we nourish one another despite our political differences, bind up the wounds of our defeats, and share our joys, both personal and social. In 1983, the Rochester Unitarian Church voted 156-1 to endorse the nuclear freeze. I use the ministers. We often get newsletters from other churches, especially if we think we might learn something from the ministers' columns. And I always learned a lot from Dick Gilbert. And in Reverend Gilbert's column, he titled Note to a Minority of One, he paid tribute to the woman, apparently everyone knew who she was, who cast that one vote. Her courage, Dick wrote, serves to remind the majority that conscience counts for something in liberal religion. The caring and the ethical are one. As we see in the image, they touch each other. For as I pointed out earlier, all four components of a healthy church are interrelated and interconnected. The third piston of our well-tuned congregational engine is religious education. By religious education, I mean more than just Sunday school. I mean a lifespan community of religious learning and growth. The main ingredient here is attitude. I'm reminded of a self-portrait at age 80 by the Spanish romantic painter and printmaker Francisco de Goya, and it's up here on the screen. And it shows the aged self-portrait. It's de Goya himself walking with the help of two canes, and it is titled, I Am Still Learning. Francisco de Goya's attitude is the attitude we seek to foster here, an attitude that we can still learn, and that we can learn to see a religious dimension in all the situations we are learning about. Moreover, we can help one another model this attitude for our children and youth, and include our young people in the other aspects of congregational life, in our celebrations, and in our social justice projects. Here, social justice is the fourth component of a healthy congregation: moral discourse and action. A few years back, I co-taught a class at one of our UU summer institutes. The class was titled Social Action in the Local Congregation. One of the participants, Carolyn, was a strong UU from one of the district's larger suburban congregations. At the week's beginning, Carolyn was adamant in her conviction that social action only divided or created divisions within churches. By the week's end, she flipped completely. She was 180 degrees. The problem at her church, as she eloquently expressed the last day, was that the social activists tended to act independently, off on their own. What she wanted and longed for was for them to be in dialogue with the whole congregation so that everyone was talking about how to be better, more wholesome people and helping each other learn new ways to be better people. Carolyn's initial feelings were not all that off base, however. Too many UU congregations are somewhat politically knee-jerk and not safe for those who don't share the majority view. But today, I am purposefully not focusing on the ways in which our congregations sometimes fall short. I am talking about something else, about religious communities that are not indoctrinating or neutral, and not political propaganda stations for the latest social action fad either. To be a true church, the church must seek to penetrate the social order with justice. But at the same time, it must not itself be co-opted into any political party or social movement. Any church worth its name will include ethical reflection as a central part of its raison d'etre. In such a congregation, moral discourse is carried on in pew and pulpit. It draws on historical for instances of ethical reflection and behavior. It delineates the moral traditions in which we stand. So, how do we get there? How do we focus and constantly refocus our energies here at East Shore Unitarian Church so that we're running at full horsepower? Well, let me propose the following. 1. First, remember to keep Sunday morning celebrative and worshipful. I've heard from a few people who have shared with me some of their hopes for worship here on Sunday during the coming year or two or three or four or five. I must tell you that I'm flattered, really, to be engaged by these folks so earnestly. Not everyone has agreed completely with the modest changes that I've already made to the order of service, and I'll make more. Others have said that they like them. Either way, your passion has forced me to articulate. Next week I'll actually speak on this subject in particular. As clearly as I can, my understanding of what worship in a liberal church is designed to do. People want to be fed and inspired on Sunday, and we Unitarian Universalists have just the message, I believe, and just the sacred circle in which to do that. Second, whatever else we do here, let us always strive to care for one another. Even the one among us with an iconoclastic point of view. Third, we have to keep our commitment to religious education high for all of us, but also especially for our young people. And finally, we have to be comfortable recognizing that there is an ethical dimension to every decision we make. Let this place be one where we can struggle together to figure out what the most ethical choices and moral behavior would be, and to support one another in acting accordingly. Here at the East Shore Unitarian Church, we are well on our way. You guys were before I arrived, but I'm helping you keep going along that line. But there is a ways we can go moving forward. In the wake of the radical religious right's many successes over the last 30 years, we will have to be focused and determined, wise as serpents and gentle as doves, if we want to articulate clearly an alternative message, one that is radical and caring, liberating and wholesome, regarding what congregational life is or can be all about. Please, over the coming months ahead, won't you join me in doing your part and helping me do my part to bring that model to fruition here in Bellevue? Thank you, and may it be so. Shalom, namaste, blessed be.